Welcome to Managing AML. I am Dr. Eunice Wang, Chief of the Leukemia Service at the Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center in Buffalo, New York. Today, I will be discussing treatment selection focused on prognostic factors. Let's begin now. These are my disclosures. I'd like to start by outlining the learning objectives for this exercise. First, I'm going to start by discussing the limitations of clinical trial criteria, which are often used to differentiate patients into fit versus unfit categories for intensive induction chemotherapy. In particular, I'd like to discuss the role of performance status and comorbidities in determining patient fitness for intensive induction therapy, as well as mention other factors that can increase the likelihood of therapeutic resistance or treatment failure. Lastly, I'd like to discuss the impact again of the comorbidity status on outcomes and how this can affect or not affect the outcomes of both high dose as well as low dose chemotherapy regimens for AML patients. As we all know, for those clinicians who treat AML, AML is a disease of older individuals. Due to clonal hematopoiesis and age-related changes due to increased mutational burden, we know that patients who present with AML are typically in their late 60s, 70s, and even 80s, with the median age of presentation between 67 to 70 years. As you can see here, the prevalence of AML increases rapidly when we get to the 60, 70, and 80 category. So patients who are considered young in AML terms are those under the age of 60 years of age, whereas the majority of patients are considered older with an age 60 to 65 and above. Do these older patients, many of whom have other medical problems and are more frail with decreased functional status, do well with intensive chemotherapy? Well, based on data acquired in the 1970s and 80s, we know that even older patients with AML can benefit from treatment as opposed to no treatment. In this study shown here on the left-hand side, 60 AML patients greater than or equal to 65 years of age were randomized to receive intensive induction chemotherapy with cytarabine and anthracycline-based regimens versus no treatment or treatment with just transfusion support and hydroxyurea. As you can see, that even in this very limited study of 60 patients, those that got the intensive chemotherapy fared better than those that got supportive care and transfusions only. Data from the Swedish registry in 2009 further confirmed this on a grander scale by looking at all patients who received induction chemotherapy in their country over a period of time. As you can see, many older patients, 60, 75 and above, were offered palliative care. But even in these older patients up to the age of 85, those receiving intensive chemotherapy again did better with lower rates of early death, defined as death within the first 30 days from their diagnosis. However, we also know that these older patients with less functional abilities, who are more frail, tend not to do nearly as well with intensive induction chemotherapy as younger patients. Shown here on the left-hand side is data showing that despite the benefit of intensive chemotherapy, the early death rate from treatment-related causes in the elderly patient can be all the way up to 20 to 40%, and that this mortality rate that we see with treatment-related mortality increases with the age on average of the patients being treated. So I'd like to discuss now a case presentation which can illustrate some of the challenges we have and how we clinically make the determination whether an individual patient is considered quote-unquote eligible or capable of receiving intensive induction therapy. This is a 71-year-old gentleman who presents with acute worsening of shortness of breath and worsening fatigue. evaluation in the white in his emergency room or the urgent care center demonstrates a white blood cell count of 22,000 with 55% myeloblasts on the peripheral smear. Hemoglobin was markedly decreased at 6 grams per deciliter, and platelets were very low at 34,000. A prior medical history for this individual patient includes a significant cardiac history with prior myocardial infarction requiring prior intervention with cardiac stent placement. Patient has a long-standing history of hypertension as well as localized prostate cancer for which he received radiation. On exam, he is a somewhat older individual who looks fine at rest, but can be easily fatigued with any sort of exertion. He's tachycardic, his lungs are clear, and he has normal and kidney and liver function on his laboratory values. Bone marrow biopsy to diagnose the acute myeloid leukemia confirms 82% myeloblasts with our rods. Follow-up studies demonstrate a complex karyotype meaning greater than or equal to 3 cytogenetic aberrations, including deletion in 17p chromosome. Mutational profiling demonstrates the presence of a p53 mutation. How would we determine whether this patient is fit or unfit for intensive chemotherapy? Now, there are a number of factors that we look at, both in the patient's presentation, as well as in our chemo regimens that help us make this determination. Shown here is a graphic which shows the different factors that can make one lean one way or the other for an individual patient. Obviously, the older the patient, the poorer their performance status, the more frail they look, and their ability to ambulate a certain distance or perform activities of daily living can be important markers of whether a patient can tolerate intensive therapy. We also know that patients who have a significant comorbidity index or many, many medical problems, who spent a lot of time in the chair or in the bed or in and out of the hospital, are also expected to do worse. And we need to also consider for these patients whether they would fare well with an intensive chemotherapy regimen, which is going to require them to be in the hospital for 4, 5, or 6 weeks as an inpatient, as opposed to their quality of life and their ability to come back and forth to the clinic for an outpatient regimen. Patient priorities need also to be considered in this treatment decision planning, because certain individuals will have strong preferences as to which treatment regimen they would prefer based on their personal needs, as well as medical and other factors. The traditional prognostic factors in AML have included high white blood cell count, high tumor burden as reflected by high LDH levels, and conventional cytogenetics. However, increasingly, we are being able to demonstrate that mutational profiling, particularly in patients who have a normal karyotype, can be incredibly important. We also know that newer biomarkers, including methods that we now have available to measure minimal or measurable residual disease at the time of remission, can also be a powerful indicator of long-term outcome. Lastly, we are increasingly aware that consideration not only of the patient's age, but other factors may be equally important in selecting for patients for this regimen. Given the fact that many of individuals are all in the same age range, it's important to look at each individual carefully to determine whether this is an 80-year-old that might do well with intensive or a 60-year-old that might not. How have we defined fit and unfit in AML therapy? Well, again, traditionally we have viewed age as the first cutoff, meaning patients between the ages of 18 and 59 in general are considered fit, and those who are greater than or equal to 60 years old who have some sort of medical issue or problem may be considered unfit. In general, though, we have been a little bit more aware that 60, 65-year-old patients can be diverse in their presentation and their functional status. So more and more, when we look at patients that are considered unfit, we're using a higher age cutoff now of 75 years and above. And this is perhaps the only cancer that we treat in the modern era where we have specific treatment regimens only for patients 75 and above. ECOG performance status, or their ability to perform daily tasks, can be perhaps the most important of the factors, and we'll discuss that a little bit later. Patients who have abnormal organ function, who have underlying liver, kidney, pulmonary, cardiac comorbidities, and high comorbidity indexes are considered general not good candidates for intensive therapy. And there can be other factors, as we mentioned, personal preference, socioeconomic issues, financial considerations, personal preferences, any of those issues, psychiatric considerations that may make the physician less likely to offer an inpatient-based regimen. In general, we've relied upon these criteria, the Ferraro criteria, which were developed in 2013 and published as potentially a laundry list encompassing many of the factors that I just mentioned, and actually defining each of the severities of organ dysfunction, which comprise not a good candidate. And these include congestive heart failure, cardiomyopathy with an EF under 50%, pulmonary function tests with patients who have underlying COPD, cirrhosis, dialysis, active infection, current mental illness, and performance status where they're really not able to take care of themselves, and that counts as three and above. Now, many of us don't go into that much detail, and we do sometimes feel, for example, that the Ferraro criteria are a little bit too stringent. For example, if I have a patient who has an ejection fraction of 49%, et cetera. So many of us have employed sort of what we call a modified Ferraro criteria. And these were used in the pivotal phase 3 trial, VIALE-A, to determine those patients who were considered unfit and eligible for enrollment on that trial of venetoclax azacitidine. In the VIALE-A trial, the modified Ferraro criteria included 75 years in age and above, minimal congestive heart failure, DLCL, and ECOG performance status, and physician discretion. What are the most commonly used methods to assess performance status? And I'm just showing you here the details of each of the most commonly used functional indexes. You can see here that the Karnofsky performance status ranks patients from 0% to 100%. And generally, we kind of use a cutoff 50 to 90% is fit. Anybody whose Karnofsky performance status is under 50% means that they're bedridden for 50% of the time and therefore not eligible for many intensive or even standard of care therapies. Within the fit population, you can see that patients in the 50, 60% category are requiring a lot of daily assistance with activities, as opposed to those who require no assistance or only have mild symptoms, which are 90 to 100%. The ECOG, also known as ZUBRA or WHO performance status, is a little bit more clean cut. You can see here, this is from 0 to 5. Anybody 3 to 5 is generally considered unfit, with patients 0 to 2 generally considered fit enough for intensive chemotherapy, 3 being the cutoff where there may be some ambiguity. Many trials will cut it off at 0 to 2. Some may consider patients with ECOG 2 to 3. There also are an increasing numbers of other indices and models that have been used to try to predict for outcomes. The Charlson Comorbidity Index, CCI, has been developed by internal medicine specialists for their ability to really delineate out all of the comorbidities that could be affecting patients. The higher the number of these chronic diseases that a patient has, and you can see leukemia is weighted as 2, the more likely that these patients are not going to live very long. Do we select AML therapy based on therapy? How good are we at selecting? How good are these factors at predicting for outcomes. And so in this particular study, we've looked in many times at patients that we consider to be fit, and we've looked at how they fare with different performance status outcomes and comorbidity indices. And you can see that fit patients who have a comorbidity index of zero can fare quite well, whereas frail patients with high comorbidity indexes and poor performance status have a fairly dismal survival that can be measured in really less than 6 months or less. In the hematologic malignancies, we often consider patients for stem cell transplantation. And so there is a comorbidity index which has been designed, particularly keeping in mind those patients that might be eligible for subsequent allogeneic stem cell transplantation. You can see here, again, very similar criteria, just delineating out on these patients with acute leukemia. When you look at comorbidities and performance status, what is potentially more predictive of outcome? Is it the number of conditions that they have, or is it their functional state? And so there are always those patients that come in whose functional state is really being brought on by the disease itself, and that treatment of the disease can improve their functional status and actually make them feel better because their initial presentation is limited by the disease manifestations. However, in general, we feel that functional status, and here the WHO or ECOG, is much more clinically relevant and linked to treatment outcome than, for example, having one or two comorbidities. What are other factors that we need to consider when considering a patient for intensive chemotherapy? I think it's important to recognize that even though a patient may be extremely fit and have an excellent performance status with a low comorbidity index and otherwise be a great candidate for intensive chemotherapy, may, despite all of our efforts, have underlying disease which biologically is unlikely to respond to intensive chemotherapy. So how do we know that? Well, we have, through many decades of investigation, determined, even now in the modern era, which cytogenetic abnormalities and which mutational abnormalities predict for poor response to cytarabine and anthracycline-based therapy. So any prognostic classification, and this one, the European Leukemia Net from 2017, is based on the treatment regimen. You can see here that this is the outcome of patients who are going to do well or not well with standard 7+3. There have been models, shown here is the AML composite model, which attempts to incorporate both the biological features as well as some of the functional features and patient-related features into one prediction model. Here you can see that they take in consideration not only the comorbidities, they take in consideration certain laboratory values, age, as well as cytogenetic and molecular risks. Using this type of integrated model, you can see here that all of the things that we really would predict are really validated. Patients who are younger and are fitter are being offered more intensive therapy. Patients who are older are really being offered less intensive therapy. Patients who have high more comorbidities, again, lower intensive therapy. Patients with cytogenetically or adverse risk category, again, more likely to be offered adverse therapy and less intensive therapy, because if you're not going to do well with intensive therapy, why go through the trouble and the risk of exposing the patient more treatment mortality with an intensive regimen? You can see here that using this integrative model, it's a combination of factors. It's not just one that is going to determine whether a patient does well. A patient could, for example, in that example I gave before, do very well and be very fit enough to tolerate the regimen, but still have refractory disease and short overall outcome because their disease, for example, contains a P53 mutation. How are we using some of these factors in the real world? How do we, in the real world setting, select for patients? So I'd like to end with just some data presented at the ASH 2021 meeting, where there was a real world study looking at in the community and academia who gets an intensive chemotherapy regimen with liposomal 7+3, CPX351, and who gets a lower intensity regimen consisting of venetoclax azacitidine. So you can see in this retrospective real world data, there were about 800 patients, both in the community and the academia center, who were looked at, who had newly diagnosed AML. About 217 of them had received CPX, 439 had received venetoclax azacitidine. Taking a deeper dive into these two patient populations, you can see that, again, there are the same inherent tendencies that I've just discussed that are occurring in real life. You can see that patients receiving venetoclax azacitidine had a median age of 75 years, as opposed to those who received CPX351. You can see that patients who had secondary disease were more likely to receive CPX351. Patients who had prior therapy-related disease also were more likely to get CPX. Patients with de novo disease who might do well without a liposomal cytarabine anthracycline-based regimen were more likely to be offered venetoclax azacitidine. And you can see that this was across the board. Were there differences in patients being selected for venetoclax azacitidine versus CPX based on their comorbidity index? And the answer was no. How about ECOG performance status? Actually, there was no difference in these patients based on their ECOG performance status. Really, it really was based on age as well as the type of AML. What were the outcomes of the study? Well, in these two patient populations, older, unfit patients, more newly diagnosed disease, as opposed to younger, fit patients, more secondary, more therapy-related disease, there were equivalent outcomes. So you can see on the left-hand side, the overall survival from diagnosis was the same when you accounted for patients going to transplant. That also was the same. The only difference between patients enrolled retrospectively in this analysis was that patients, regardless of what induction chemotherapy they got, if they were able to go to stem cell transplantation, they did universally better than those that didn't. So what do we take from this analysis? We take that there is two kind of populations of patients out there. There are the older, more unfit, and there's the younger, more fit. Is there a difference in toxicities with these regimens? Yes. Patients who received CPX351, as we would expect, had a much higher rate of febrile neutropenia, documented infection, and almost three times the inpatient stay as opposed to those that got venetoclax azacitidine. So if you are to offer that, you probably need to select patients who are going to be able to tolerate that. Regardless of which patients were selected for which therapy, overall survival was the same. So this suggests that as clinicians, we are doing a good job of selecting the appropriate therapy for the appropriate patients based on all of this information that we have on prognostic factors. The important factor here was to get them through the induction chemotherapy with the potential for some of them to go to transplant. So going back to the case presentation we talked about, the 71-year-old gentleman who had an ECOG performance status of 1 with probably at least 2 or 3 or 4 comorbidities, what would this patient be considered? I would consider this patient to be falling into the unfit category based on their questionable comorbidities, but also they're not so much their ECOG performance status, but potentially based on the fact that they have a poor karyotype AML with a P53 mutation. So although there are some factors, the ECOG performance status in particular, which would favor a more aggressive approach, the comorbidities and the overall impression incorporating the biological factors suggests that this patient may benefit from a lower intensity regimen with decreased toxicity. So As we talked about in summary, we've discussed some of the clinical trial criteria used to standardly differentiate patients into fit and unfit. We talked about performance status, comorbidity. We've talked about the impact of the underlying biology. And we've talked a little bit about how we're doing this in the real world. And with that ASH abstract showing us how clinicians are already differentiating an intensity of therapy based on these factors. I'd like to thank everybody for your attention. I hope this was a useful exercise and that this is going to help you as you move forward in selection of patients for future AML therapy.